We are beginning Perek Chaf Bet. Now, Perek Chaf Bet really is the continuation of Perek Chaf Aleph. In many ways, it's one story. And if the main theme of Perek Chaf Aleph was David in Nov, and the aftermath of his sojourn in Nov, the continuation of the story of Nov is Shaul. And Shaul comes running after David to Nov, eventually in a fit of anger, destroys Nov. Right, all of that is part of that story. And that's the second half of Perek Chaf Bet. But in the meantime, we have a couple of stories, midway, that interrupt the flow of the story of Nov. Just to give you a sense, if you were to run from Perek Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud, the end of Pasuk Yud, where David says, Vayomer David en kamot neneli, takes the sword of Goliath. If you were to go from there, skip, and go straight to Pasuk Perek Chaf Bet, Pasuk Vav, Veishma Shaul ki nadad David vanasha vanashim ashirito b'Shaul yoshe b'givat tachat ha'eshel b'rama v'chanito b'yado v'chol avadav nitzavim alav v'yomer Shaul avadav etzat. If Shaul hears that David was found, that David was discovered, the rest of those pesukim I'm going to skip for a moment, and pasuk tet v'yan doeg ha'adomi v'hu nitzav alav dei Shaul v'yomer v'aiti et ben Yishai ban Nove. I saw David. He came to Nov. He was seen. God. He inquired of God. He asked for the sword. Gave him bread. So Shaul calls Achimelech, and he calls him over, and he has a whole conversation with him. And then in the end, he gets angry, and he tries to destroy. Pasuk Tetzayin, Vayomer HaMelech. I'm going to read these psukim in detail later, but I'm just giving you a sense. Vayomer HaMelech, Mot Tamut Achimelech, Ata V'chol Beit Avicha, Achimelech, you're going to die. Vayomer HaMelech, L'Ratzim HaNitzavim Alav, Sobo V'Amitu Kohane Hashem, go and kill all of the Kohanim in the city. Gigam Yadamim David, they also assisted David, and they refuse to do it. They think it's an absolute shanda. Vayomer HaMelech L'Doeg, Sovatav Gad B'Kohanim, so he turns to Doeg Adomi, who had no problem being Malshin on David in the first place. He says, okay, Doeg, you finish the job. And he does, and he goes and he executes the entire city of Nov and destroys the Mishkan. If you were to run from Perek Chaf Aleph, from the story of David and Nov, straight to the middle of Perek Chaf Bet, to the Shaul's wrath poured out on Nov, it would be one story. We call that the framework. Right, the Mizgeret, the framework of the Perek. But inserted in between is a completely, I wouldn't say completely tangential, but certainly in the flow of the story of Nov, a tangential series of stories. The first one we already looked at, which was last Monday. Right, that was the story of David in Gat with Achish, Philistine king of Gat, where he acts crazy in order to escape the Plishtim, etc. That story begins in Perek Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayakom David vayivrach bayom ahum mipnei Shaul vayavo al Achish melech Gat. That day he runs, and he runs to Achish, he runs to Gat. So you could argue, or you could claim, that the reason that that story is here is because from Nov, David escapes to Gat, and Shaul, in the meantime, comes to Nov. So we're looking at two stories that are happening almost in parallel. David is running to Gat. In the meantime, Shaul comes to Nov. Shaul is always lagging a step behind David. So we hear the story of Gat, and then we return to the story of Shaul to Nov. That flow, I could understand. The problem is that the story of David doesn't stop there. And from David's escape from Achish Melech Gat, we then encounter several stories that clearly are out of place chronologically. It's very hard to put these stories into the sequence of the flow of David in Nov, Shaul comes back to Nov. Where Shaul is geographically, and let me just give you, if you look at the map that you have, the very top of the map, where it says Ahimelech gives David sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Do you see that box? Mm-hmm. So that's where Nov is. I'm going to give you a Google aerial map in a minute, but that's where Nov is. If you look just beneath it is Yevus. That's right. That's Yerushalayim. If you look above it, you'll see Giv'av Shaul and Ramah, mm-hmm. 1 and 2. These numbers are the sequences of events in Sefer Shmuel. So 1 and 2 is David and Shaul in Givat Shaul. Givat Shaul is where Shaul's kingdom is, which is just north of Yerushalayim. So the whole story with David and Yonatan and the arrows and the Rosh Chodesh feast, etc., all of that's in 1 and 2. David runs. He runs to Nov. That's 3. From 3, David runs to Gat. Now follow the line all the way out to Gat. So what would take longer, for David to reach Gat or for Shaul to reach Nov? That's not much of a question.
Yeah.
Okay. So given, let's assume for the moment there's a little bit of time lag, because Doeg has to come back to Yerushalayim, to Givat Shaul, and Shaul has to hear that David was discovered or found, etc. He has to find out about this information. Let's assume for a moment that takes time. Granted, David has a head start. David can get to Gat more or less in parallel to Shaul hearing about Nob. And I'm assuming that the events of David in Gat are more or less parallel to the story of Shaul, his reaction to David and Nov. But then we read the following. Now we're going to start Parakhov Bet. I'm only going to read 5 psukim today. Vayelech David Misham. From Gat, David continues to go. Vayimalet el ma'arat Adulam. I'm beginning of Parakhov Bet. And he takes refuge in the cave of Adulam. Vayishmu echav v'cho beit aviv vayirdu elav shama. There in Marat Adulam, David gathers together with the rest of his family. Kho beit aviv. His family live in Beit Lechem. They hear, or they know, that David is on the run. More importantly, maybe David sent a message to them, or in some fashion, if you look at source 1, I didn't number the sources, I apologize. If you look at the first source on the page, Vayishmu Achav, the brothers hear, Ki barach David, that David ran, Pachadu l'nafsham, they were afraid for their lives, Pen yitnakem bahem Shaul, lest Shaul take revenge against them, V'leze yardu el David. So they ran from Beit Lechem to join David.
Well, I thought they did it to support him.
Well, there's 2 different groups here. We'll see that there's a second group, but the family? Uh-huh. I suspect the family ran because they're not safe, which is essentially what Jonathan told them. You're not safe anywhere. You're not safe in Beit Lechem, because that was the excuse that David had told Jonathan to give to Shaul, that he wasn't at the feast because he went to his family in Beit Lechem. Well, his family then becomes complicit in the treason. So now his family's not safe. So his family has to leave. So his family comes and joins him in Marat Adulam, which I'll show you in a moment where that is. And that also takes time. Let me just read through the psukim. Vayitkabtzu elav, there in Marat Adulam, he gathers together kol ish matzok v'chol ish asher lo noshe v'chol ish mar nefesh v'hi alehem lesar. he gathers around him a group of people that are people that are distressed, people that have noshe. Noshe is a creditor, debts, but in the biblical context, a creditor can not only take your money and your estate, but if you don't pay, he can take your children. There's a story like that in Sefer Malachim.
Wow,
it was a very difficult time, and if somebody had those kinds of debts, they were really distressed. They certainly had no land, because at this point, if they have got creditors coming to knock on their door, then they are in trouble. V'chol ish mar nefesh, bitter. V'hi alehem l'sa, and over them, David became a kind of a symbol, a leader. V'hi uimo. Kerbam Yodish, and he gathered this group of people, approximately 400 people. We're going to spend some time talking about this group. Vayelech David Misham, Mitzpe Moav. From there he went to Mitzpe Moav. Vayomer el Melech Moav, Yetzeina Avivi Imi Itchem Ada Sheredam Ayaseli Elokim. Says to the king of Moav, do me a favor, let my father and mother, I assume the rest of his family, stay with you, because they're not safe with me, until I find out what my destiny is going to be, what God will have in store for me. Ma ya'aseh li elokim. Vayanchem et pnei melech Moav. The melech Moav accepts this offer. Vayeshvu imo ko yimei hayot David b'mtzuda. His father and mother and family stayed with the king of Moav so long as David was in the fortress. Vayomer Gad the Navi. No, he's in Mitzudat Moav, Mitzpe Moav.
Oh.
Whether Mitzpe Moav and Mitzudat Moav are the same thing, we'll talk about.
Wait.
Yeah. I understand the confusion. We'll have to resolve the locations.
Okay.
Mitzudat is a fortress. Mitzpe Moav is an outlet. We'll talk about these things.
Okay. I trust.
Vayomer Gad the Navi al David lo teshev Mitzudat. Says God to Hanavi, to David, "Now enough in the fortress. Lech uvata lecha el eretz Yehuda. It's time to come back to the land of Yehuda. Ve'elech David ve'yavo Ya'ar Charet. Comes back to Ya'ar Charet. Where is Ya'ar Charet? It is, and where it is exactly is not our issue for now. Near Kila, we'll talk about that. That's the next, has to do with the next parak. So clearly, it takes time to gather a force of 400 people in Marat Adullah, and to gather his family, and to go to Eretz Moav.
So God comes.
God is always with him. God is with him the whole time. There are only two references to the Navi God in Sefer Shmuel, here and in the end of the Sefer, which is part of the same period of time. We assume that God is just with him.
When
he just doesn't have a large role.
As well. And when he went to Plishtim?
He's not mentioned. He's mentioned once here and once in the end of the Sefer. So more than that, anything is conjecture. So, but it's an interesting kind of insertion of a series of stories that are unrelated to the flow of information. So, on the one hand, you could say simply, and we're going to start, that once we're already talking about his journey out to God, so there's a flow. So we're going to finish the story of that flow. He goes to Eretz Plishtim, goes to Gat, comes back, goes to Eretz Moav, comes back. You know, there are these two moments where he goes abroad. He's gathering his forces, gathering his family. There are clearly two groups of people that are traveling with him. There is his family, and there is right, and there are all these dressed people, and he's gathering them together. And he's addressing them and their needs, etc. And he's beginning to assert a certain kind of leadership over them and a responsibility for them. And so all of this is taking place. Once we began that story, we kind of finished it. But it's somewhat of an unsatisfying answer, because it would have made more sense, once we started the story of Nov, to finish the story of Nov, and then to start with Vayivrach David, and he ran to Gat, and from Gat he ran to Adullam, and Adullam he ran to Moab, and etc. Right? If I'm already taking the approach that once we start one story, we're going to finish it, then we should have done that with Nov. Right? Start the story of Nov, finish the story of Nov, and then move on to the story of David. Why stop in the middle of Nov? Why split the story of Nov to these moments or these stories? So I'm going to throw that out as kind of a broad, general question at the outset of our study of this parak. That's going to be there for us to come back to as towards the end of our study. It'll take us a couple of weeks, but we're going to get there. Yes?
Is this the first time we're seeing the Navi God?
The first time we see the Navi God, yes. And the only other time is probably the same time period, but it's a parak at the end of Shmuel.
And he's with him in Moab, and he tells him to go back.
Again, that was the question that was asked before. We don't know. I think Sunny asked it. We don't know when God joins him.
Nice.
I'm going to make one assumption. Shmuel, I'm going to make the following assumption. You will never have more than one Navi engaged with the king at any given time. That's an assumption that works through all of Tanakh. A king has a Navi. Shaul has one Navi. His name is Shmuel. David has three Navi, but at different periods of his life.
Shmuel,
God, and Natan. But never simultaneously. Never overlap. So I'm assuming that as David leaves Shmuel, or leaves the palace and goes on the run, at some point as he's on the run, God comes with him. When? We have no way of knowing. But I'm assuming that God is there to accompany him through the journey till he assumes the throne. Once he comes to Yerushalayim and he assumes the throne in Yerushalayim, Natan enters the picture. Natan is the Navi to David in Yerushalayim. God is the Navi to David while he's en route, on journey, or in running. Throughout this period of time. How long it is, we don't know, but throughout this period of time. We talked about this a little bit when we talked about the structure of Sefer Shmuel, the transition between Perek Tzayin, Perek Yud Zayin, the introduction between Shaul and David, Kolyat, the whole confusion of the story, the suggestion that different prakim are written by different Nevi'im, because the Gemara says that Shmuel wrote his Sefer, but Shmuel dies at some point in Shmuel Aleph. And God and Natan wrote other parts of it. So this is clearly part of what we would call Pirkei Gad. The story is written by Gad HaNavi, who is accompanying David in this journey.
So God must be like more athletic if he's the one on the run.
I don't think it's a function of athletics. All right. So a couple of things about geography. Again, the chronology we're going to come back to, why these stories are all here in the middle of the story of Nov, we will eventually come back to. But we're going to now begin to focus on this story from Gat, not to be confused with God, nor with God. I kind of have to keep our names straight. From Gat, David runs to Ma'arat Adullam. Where and what is Ma'arat Adullam? If you look on this map that you have, this English map, and the places are numbered. So 1, 2, 3 is near Nov, top. Then he runs to Gat, which is 4. And from 4 he runs to Adullam. Number 5. I love the box. Malcontents gather around David.
Right? Malcontents.
Mary Nefesh.
What a word.
There you go.
Right. We're going to talk about exactly who they are. But that is Adullam. Now, where Adullam is today, there's actually a park around there, and you can actually go. I think there's I think there's actually a cave they assume is the cave of Adullam, although it's probably more conjecture than anything else. This is an interesting map that I'm going to share with you. It's actually a screenshot off the computer of... couldn't really find a way to print it, so I just did a screenshot and I put it in color. Now there's two sides to this map. So the front side, you'll see, is a aerial view. It's so much clearer on the computer. I'm sorry, the printout did not come out well.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was the original one. It's just much clearer. So
this side you're talking.
I'm talking about the side that has, not the side that has a modern map, the side that does not have a modern map,
right.
Just an aerial map.
Right.
It looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it only has four places on it.
Right.
Ramah, or Nov, on the top on the right. Far left, Gat.
Mm-hmm.
You see that?
Yeah.
Adullam,
mm-hmm.
And Moab.
Right.
This is a good map to see distances.
To the right.
And Yehuda, right? Everything south of Yerushalayim is Yehuda, and east of the Jordan is, or east of the Dead Sea, I should say, is Moab. See where we are?
Uh-huh.
Here.
Yeah.
Gat, Adullam, this is Eretz Yehuda.
Is here.
This is the Dead Sea.
And this is God.
To the right of the Dead Sea is Moab.
Oh, here's Moab.
Moab? Well, Moab's a long area. Moab is a big area. Adullam?
South of
Beit
Shemesh.
No.
Yes.
Right here. Isn't this Adullam? And here's Beit Shemesh.
And it's east of...
Oh, Beit Shemesh. Sorry, I thought you said Beit Shemesh. Yes, east. South of... If you look on the other side of the map,
right.
You will see that Adullam is almost due west of... You don't see it on this map? Almost due west of Alon Shvut and Kfar Etzion. If you do a straight line from Alon Shvut, you would reach Adullam, almost on the...
Efrat.
You see, as I said, it didn't print out. Kfar Etzion and Alon Shvut didn't print out at this level of...
Side. Here's Adullam.
I see where Adullam is. Where's Efrat?
It's also not that far
from Adullam is Adullam is on
here,
the...
I see, but where's Efrat? Oh, I see Efrat.
Yeah.
Where's Efrat?
Right
on
right
60.
Here.
Turn it over. Turn it over.
And then go to the right is Efrat.
Right.
Now,
60.
You can do this all yourself. HaTanach.com has a Google Map interface with a biblical map.
Yeah.
I've told you about this before. It's a really interesting exercise. They literally have a Google Map engine with a modern Google Map superimposed on a biblical map.
That's unbelievable.
And that's what you've got right here. You've got your biblical map. And you have your modern Google map, and you can go boom, and you can see exactly where these places are. It's really cool. But you get a sense of where David is going. Yerushalayim, beginning north, the eastern ridge, let's say, of the Gaza Strip today. Then the border between the Green Line and the Yehuda, and over the Green Line, if you will. Adullam is just on that border. Just due west of Alon Shvut.
Mm-hmm.
Then he's got to cross all the way out to Moab.
Oh, yeah.
All the way
maybe.
The way
maybe.
That's
okay, that's debatable. And that's debatable. Where
that's
he gets
distance.
To Mitzpeh Moab is debatable, but he comes out to Mitzpeh Moab, and then he's going to come back. Teretz Yehuda.
That's a lot of travel.
So he is traveling the breadth, the width of Eretz Yehuda from one end to the other, back and forth. This is why this map looks the way it does. Okay, all the back and forth. Okay, this is the area in which David is going to find refuge from Shaul.
Yeah.
And it's not an accident that it's in Eretz Yehuda, because that's his home territory. If he's going to find protection from Shaul's wrath, it's going to be amongst his brethren, in the broader sense of the term, in Eretz Yehuda. Shaul knows this. This is the beginning of the civil war between the forces of Yehuda and the forces of Binyamin.
I think last week I wrote Moab next to Adullam. Wasn't there something?
No, next to Adullam? No.
No, Moab.
Moab is, it goes from Adullam.
It's all the way over here.
Yeah, it's far.
No,
far.
No, Adullam is not near Moab. He goes to Mitzpe Moab, but from Adullam. But Adullam is on the border between, Adullam is at that time, and that's really the piece that we wanted to get to. Adullam is really, for all intents and purposes at that time, the border between Eretz Plishtim and Eretz Yehuda. The question is why he runs to Adullam. What's significant about Adullam? And there isn't a clear... So he's first of all, it's in the mountains, but there isn't a clear indication as to why Adullam specifically, except maybe that's where he found the place to rest. But I think that on the one hand, Adullam sounds like he's returning to Eretz Yisrael, or he's turning to Mamlechet Sha'ul. He's taken this effort to go to Eretz Plishtim that didn't work, so he's coming back to the territory of Israel. On the other hand, if he's sitting in Adullam and there he's gathering his forces, what gives him the security to think that he can gather his forces in Adullam more than, I don't know, Be'er Sheva, Beit Shemesh, anywhere else in Eretz Yehuda? And I think the answer lies in the fact that Adullam is, for all intents and purposes, a sort of a no man's land on the border between Eretz Plishtim and Eretz Yehuda. It's on the Eretz Yehuda side, but it's border territory.
So you get over the border.
Now,
on the outskirts.
Why is border territory significant? And here we need to just remember that borders in biblical context are very different than borders in modern times. Borders in modern times are defined by lines on a map and sometimes a wall. Okay? That's what defines a border. Lines on a map and sometimes other security fences to maintain a border. Not in the biblical arena. By definition, there are no clear boundaries between countries, other than unless there's a geographical border, that are defined on a map by a line. What you have are cities. For example, in the list of all the nachalot of the different shvat, Sefer Yehoshua. We talked about this back in Sefer Yehoshua, if anybody remembers that back that far. The Torah doesn't list the boundaries of the divisions between the tribes. It lists the names of the cities that lie along that border. And sometimes those cities are marked as belonging to both sides of the border. Like Yerushalayim, which is listed as a city belonging to Yehuda and listed as a city belonging to Binyamin, because it's on the border. To whom does it belong doesn't matter. It's just that that's a city that sits on the border between the two tribes. It's not a line and a map. It's a general area. So if you talk about any place between two cities, that's no man's land. It's not a border in a literal sense of the term. It's just they're not cities there. And tends to be, the general approach is, the border areas tend to be less secure. And especially if there's no wall and there's no security fence and there's no map, then border areas are basically open. There is no control over the border. The forces tend to gather in high places, in secure fortresses, in places where the army meet, etc. They're not going to go to the border unless there's a war. And so a border actually is a much more... a much less controlled space than the heartland of the tribe is. Less people, less recognized, less tread upon, less watched. So if David is trying to escape and he can't escape in Eretz Plishtim, the next best place for him to be would be on the outskirts of Shevet Yehuda, on the border with Eretz Plishtim. Sort of safe a little bit from Eretz, from the Plishtim, safer a little bit from the forces of Sha'ul. He can hide in the cave, he can hide in the hills. It's an area that is less likely to become not less likely to be discovered. If he goes into a city, somebody's going to recognize him. You already had that experience at Nov, right? We went to Nov with the Mishkan, and somebody it was one of Shaul's forces recognized him. Doi Gadomi. Doesn't want to make that mistake again, and so he kind of begins to hide in the mountains or in the hills or in the caves in this border territory between Yehuda and Eretz Plishtim. Why he leaves there, we'll see.
So he's not by himself.
At this point, he's still by himself till he gets to Adullam.
But is that...
And then he begins to gather around him
his family
and his followers, and we're going to talk about that next.
But because of the situation of what the place was, is that why the distressed people were there?
Oh, so that's what we're going to get to exactly now. What we're going to get to next is who are these malcontents? That's a really good word. Who are these malcontents? These distressed people who come to gather around David. Vayitkabtzu elav kol ish matzot. What was that? Vayitkabtzu elav kol ish matzot v'kol ish shelo noshe v'kol ish mar nefesh v'yi alehem. So who are these malcontents and distressed people? They are my nefesh, bitter. They are anshe matzok, distressed. Ashelon noshe, they have debts. They owe money or land, or they're in great trouble. What essentially does all of that point to?
Maybe everyone wasn't so happy with Shaul.
So it could be that they are, that the source of their discontent and their troubles could be coming from Shaul. That is a distinct possibility. We're going to work through that possibility in a minute. Right, I think that's very true. I think there's actually textual evidence to that point. But the notion of gathering around him a group of people who are anshe matzok, mar nafesh, this is not an unprecedented experience. We have seen this phenomenon before. Right? Where kind of the renegade gathers around them other renegades or other people of similar kind of status of... But what makes them renegades, what makes them malcontents, what makes them anshe matzok mar nafesh, in the context here, how do they earn a parnasa? How do they make a living?
So they're more likely to be mercenaries.
Okay, they end up becoming mercenaries. They end up becoming they end up plundering nomadic tribes that are traveling through and protecting. We'll see that very quickly. We're protecting the local areas, farms, and lands from marauders and plunderers. Right? They become a kind of a mishmar hagvul, if you will. Right? They become a kind of a border patrol. Right? And that's exactly what they do. They end up protecting all of the settlements in the area of Yehuda and the area of, and even the Plishtim, right? From the various marauding tribes that come through and plunder and steal, like Amalek, like Midian, where nomadic tribes that plunder fields. Amalek in particular will become an issue for us. And David protects those cities and communities around where, because he has a band of warriors, and they're strong. They're warriors. But they all have one thing in common, which allows them to develop into this band of protectors of farmers and farmland. They all have one thing in common.
They can't get a real job.
Because, they're correct. They can't get a real job because, well, it's a question of what's the chicken or the egg? Mm-hmm. Why can't they get a real job? What's a real job in those days?
Farming,
right? It's an agricultural society. They don't have land. Right? And if you don't have land, by definition, you end up falling into this crack. In that world, in the arena of an agricultural society, if you don't have land, you are either a pauper gleaning from the fields or a shomer guarding other lands from other marauders, or you're dead. Because those are your options. That's the engine of the economy, mm-hmm. is agriculture's land. That's why the whole Torah has a whole set of rules, halachot pertaining to if you're in debt and you have no money and you sell your land, then you can redeem your land back. And the mechanism for gulat hakarka to redeem that land back, because without land, you're finished. And Yovel that returns the land to your ancestral to the ancestral line, because land is everything in that arena. We've seen this twice before in Tanakh, both in the same book. Not Shmuel.
That narrows it.
Shoftim. We've seen it twice in Shoftim. Anybody remember where? That's a good excuse.
I was working.
Take a look at Perek Yud Aleph. Who's the most famous, literally, exile in Sefer Shoftim? Who is the individual who is exiled from his ancestral land in Sefer Shoftim?
Yiftach,
correct. And take a look what happens with Yiftach. Perek Shoftim, Perek Yud Aleph.
It's 307.
Yiftach HaGiladi Aya Gibor Chayel Vuhu Ben Isha Zona Vayoled Gilad Et Yiftach. Background to Yiftach is complicated, but he is a warrior, is of a great strength. He is a child with complicated relationships. Vateled Eshet Gilad Lobanim, he's the son from another woman, or a harlot, or some other woman. His primary wife has other children. Vayigdalu b'nei Yisha, Gilad's children grow up. Vayigarshu et Yiftach. They expel Yiftach. They send him on his way. Vayomru lo lo tinchal bevet avinu ki men Yisha acheret ata. You shall not have a land inheritance with our father. You are a child from another mother. You are illegitimate. You are gone. Goodbye. Yiftach, boom. Gets thrown out. So now Yiftach becomes immediately, by definition, what do we call him? A malcontent. Right? No land. Okay? No land. And he's a Gibor Chayil. So because he's a Gibor Chayil, it makes sense that he's going to find himself a form of Parnassa, which isn't necessarily your typical nice, clean job of farming land. Right? Now suddenly you're going to end up in a more complex relationship. Vayivrach Yiftach mifnecha vayesh be'eretz tov. Goes off into the Eretz Tov, runs away from his brothers. Vayitlaktu al Yiftach anashim rekim. Vayitzu imo. Who does he gather around him? Anashim rekim. Now, anashim rekim has multiple meanings. Anashim rekim can mean worthless, valueless people, rik in terms of a moral judgment.
Or poor.
Or poor, have nothing.
Or how about without land?
Or without land.
That's the meaning.
What does Ruth say, since we're talking about Ruth this weekend, what does Ruth say when she comes back from Moab? Meleya halachti vereka meshivani Hashem. I've gone full, I came back empty. Why? Because she has no land. Rek means no land. So who does he gather around him? Anashim rekim. People without land. By definition without land, you are matzok, in distress, and with debts, and all of the descriptions that David's people have as well. One other individual who fits into this category, although he is a little bit less, a little bit more of the thug character, and that's Avimelech. Remember Avimelech at all? Avimelech is one who kills all of his 70 brothers in order to attain a throne. Son of Gidon, really not a nice character. Perek Tet, same sefer Shoftim. Perek Tet, pasuk Dalid. So there it says. Again, Avimelech is an exile. Avimelech is the illegitimate son of Gidon. Comes to his brothers in Shechem and he says he wants to rule over them. Pasuk Dalid, Vaitnu lo shivim kesef mibeit balbrit vayiskor behem avimelech. Avimelech goes and he hires with this money that the people of Shechem give him anashim rikim ufochazim, people who are empty, malcontents, landless, but pochazim. Pochaz means pachaz kamaim.
Reckless.
That's a good word. Reckless. Quick, hasty, reckless. Why is it? So that's already a value judgment. That's not about the situation of their distress. That's about their moral character.
But it says here, for
and
Rakim
therefore,
vain.
What?
And here it says, Rakim is vain. That's such a ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. I'm not going to have with that translation. But Rakim, Pochazim is reckless, and that is exactly what they are, because here, Vayavo bet Aviv Ephrata, Vyarog et Achav b'nei Yerubal Shivimish, 11 Achat. And there he takes these people, and what does he do with them? He goes and he kills 70 brothers. Melech is not a nice guy. It can be a very pejorative, very negative description, Anashim Rekimu Pochazim. On the other hand, amongst David's group, the uniting factor between them is that they are Mari Nefesh, they are Ishmatzok, they are in distress, they are troubled, they've got debts, they've got the debt collectors coming and knocking on their doors. They have no land. And therefore they will gather together in a group that David builds into a
force,
into a force, yeah, into a gedud, into a unit, a military unit.
Right.
And he will rule over them like a military unit, with a structure, with a command structure. It says very clearly, let's go back to our perek, Vayu alehem, Vayi alehem lesar. Right, back to our perek in Shmuel. Back to where we were. Pasuk Chabet Bet. Whenever I go to another parak, I always keep my finger on the parak where we started, because that way you come back to it. They are a kind of gedud. They are kind of a unit. He's their general. This is a military structure. It's very different than the feel you get from Avimelech or from Yiftach. This is orderly. David commands them. David rules over them. David controls them. And he does so very, very, very efficiently. And very effectively, I should say. This is David's gedud. You know, there's a fascinating Gemara in a fascinating Gemara in. Did I put it on the page? No, I did not. Ah! I meant to. I missed that one. My apologies. I'm just going to read it to you. It's Gemara Masechet Brachot. That describes this period of time. Now, like many midrashim, it is somewhat anachronistic because it describes David in a kind of experience in the palace with his harp and a kind of midnight waking up and the harp playing and that kind of experience. But it's clear from the context that what we're talking about is this period of David's life. And the story that the Gemara describes is as follows. At midnight, the north wind would blow and it would play the harp, and David would wake up and he would engage in the study of Torah until the morning dawn came. Once the dawn came, all of the elders of Israel, the Chachamim, would come in to him. And they would say to him, Amulo Adonenu Amelach, the master, the king, Amcha Yisrael Tzlichin Parnasa. Your people of Israel are in desperate need of Parnasa. Which clearly is not relevant to the period of time when David is in Yerushalayim and in the kingdom, and the kingdom is prosperous, and he's got a major army and wars all over. This is a different. The context is anachronistic, but time frame, I think, is clearly related to this period where David is on the run. Amar lehem, he said to them, L'chuit panasu zemiseh, so go and give each other jobs. If the people are in need of parnasa, so find parnasa. Omulu ena komets matzbiat ari. There's no money. There's no food. There's no water. There's no vinegar. There's nothing to provide parnasa with. Ena bor mitmalei mechuyato. You can't fill up a ditch with the dirt that you pulled out of it. It's not sufficient. There isn't enough. Internally, there isn't enough. The metaphor here is that within the Jewish community, within amongst themselves, there isn't enough resources. There aren't enough resources to provide parnasa. Right? You take a hole, you dig the dirt out of the hole. You can't put the dirt back. There isn't enough. That's the metaphor. Ein abor mitmalem mechuyato. Amar lahem. So he said to them, Lechu pashtu yedechem b'gdud. Go and extend your hand against the armies of the marauders. Pashtu yedechem b'gdud. Go and gird your swords and go and fight. So, what's he just? And that's where the Gemara leaves off. And the suggestion is that they would then get their parnasa from raiding other groups and stealing food. It's a difficult description to assign to David HaMelech, and certainly not a description relevant to a time when David is sitting in the palace with an army and a legal structure and a Sanhedrin this is not. But it's very appropriate for David leading a band of Mari Nefesh who have no land. And the only form of parnasa these people have, the only way to survive, is either to raid or to collect parnasa from those whose lands are typically raided and whom they then therefore protect. And that becomes the story of David. Right? Remember the story of Naval HaKarmeli, which will come later, or other groups where he asks them to pay his wages for the service that they provide. Some do willingly, and when they don't, David gets very angry at them because he's providing them the service of protecting them from the Amalek and the Moabites and all of the other and Midianites and all of the other marauding tribes that are coming through and pillaging the land. And that's David's world. So if you think about where David has come from and where he is now ending up. But this is the beginning of the rise of Malchut David. This is where David's leadership begins to assert itself. It's a fascinating period of time because it's trial by fire. David's leadership is forged in the exile in Eretz Yehuda with these 400 landless people who he forges into a gedud, into a unit. In contrast to Shaul, who's got an entire army, and where that leads. Okay, one last piece about this gedud. We don't know a lot about how they enter into this state of being. Just people could be that the border itself is an area that tends to be less controlled, less land, less. It could be that that's because he's on the border; he's able to gather those forces around him. However, there is some evidence to the fact that they're not in this position accidentally, and that there could be amongst all of them a kind of target blame for the distress that they're in. What do I mean by that?
They did something wrong?
No, I don't think they did something. Well, that's unclear, but the common denominator amongst all of them, I believe, is that they have somebody to blame for their situation. And the most likely target for that is going to be the king.
Why would that be the king?
why would that be the king? So that's exactly what I wanted to show you. So take a
look. We're going to go back to the original thing where you're sure you want a king.
So
you have to pay him taxes and this and that.
That's exactly right. So take a look, and I'll show you an interesting piece. Again, this whole story is out of place because we're sitting in the middle of the story of Nov, right? All of this is much later, but it's sitting here in the middle of the story of Nov. And we don't have an answer to the question of why it's sitting here in the middle of the story of Nov. Right. But take a look a few psukim later, after the sojourn in Moav, which is our next unit, which we're not going to get to today. Shmuel, Perek of Bet Pasuk Zayin. We're just going to jump a little bit ahead to the next part of the story. Vayomer Shaul la'avadav. We're back to
Shaul.
Back to Shaul. Vayomer Shaul la'avadav hanitzavim alav. Shaul turns to all of his servants who are. Actually, no. I can go back one pasuk. Vav. Vayishma Shaul ki nada David. Shaul heard that David was found out, discovered. Banashim ashirito. So maybe not so anachronistic, right? He's got people with him. Shaul yoshev b'givah tachat ha'eshel b'ramah. Shaul is sitting under the eshel tree in Ramah. V'chanito b'yado. Remember, we once talked about the fact that Shaul's spear is never far from his hand. M'chol avadav nitzavim alav. All of his servants standing over him. You get a sense of the majesty and grandeur of Shaul's operation in contrast to the roughness of David. Vayomer Shaul la'avadav hanitzavim alav, Shimon b'nei Yemini, turns to his servants, who are all from Shevet Binyamin, because he's sitting in Shevet Binyamin. Now he's upset about something. What's he upset about? He's upset that he has to hear about David through the grapevine, that he has to hear the rumors. Why is it upsetting to him that he has to hear the rumors? Yonatan's not coming. In other words, he is the king. He should have at his fingertips an entire operation of informants and spies and military soldiers and special forces and intelligence forces and CIA and FBI and whatever else, Homeland Security, whatever else is going on. And he should have all of this at his fingertips. And if he's sitting in Givat Shaul, he's sitting in the mine, he can't figure out where David is, and he has to hear through the rumor that maybe David was discovered in the city of Nov, which is, what, 2 kilometers from him. Mm. It's astounding to him. And he can only come up with one excuse, which is that people are
against
him. Right? That people are hiding David, that people are harboring David, that they're not, that they're taking sides with David. So he gets angry. And he says to them, גם לכולכם ייתן בן ישי שדות וכרמים לכולכם ישים שרי אלפים ושרי מאות. You think בן ישי, there's that pejorative reference again, בן ישי. You think בן ישי is going to give you fields and vineyards, and he's going to make you captains of hundreds and thousands, he's going to make you generals and armies and captains and colonels. You think David is going to give you all these things? כי קשרתם כולכם עליי, that you have all rebelled against me? How? Ve'en golet ozni bichrot bni im ben Yishai, that you do not let me know when my own son makes an alliance with ben Yishai? You think you're going to get more benefit from David? He's going to give you fields and vineyards. He's going to make you captains and officers. Ve'en cholemikem alai ve'golet ozni. Not one of you is willing to tell me where he is. Ki kim b'ni et avdi alai lo'orev kayom ezem. When my own son is willing to ambush me by aligning with David. Right, so the story of Yonatan is complicated, but clearly he thinks that Yonatan is part of this cabal. But what's his accusation to the people? Why are they hiding David?
They're conspiring.
They're conspiring because they think David's going to take better care of them. That David's going to give them back the lands and the vineyards and the positions and the status that they seem to be lacking under Shaul. And the reference here to Sadot and Kremim is very interesting, because the notion of land being given back by the king versus land being taken by the king brings us exactly back to that Parashat HaMelech. That's exactly what it brings us back to. And I put these two paragraphs side by side. I wanted to show you something very interesting. Put these two paragraphs side by side on the source page. On the right side, the psukim that I just read. On the left side, the psukim in Parashat HaMelech, back in Parakhet, where Zeyim Mishpat HaMelech. Remember that? So, on the left side, what does it say? B'nechem yikach, he'll take your children, v'samlo b'merkavto, and put your children into his chariots, u'befarashav, and on his horses, v'ratzu lifnei merkavto, they will run before his chariot, v'lasum lo sarei alafim b'sarei chamishim, and to be his captains and his officers, and to plow his fields, and to harvest his harvests, and to make his tools of war, and your daughters he'll take to make to bake and to make the tapestry, the clothing, and to do all whatever needs to be done to support the army operation. Pasuk Gedalit ve'etzdotechem ve'et karmechem v'zetechem atovim yikach v'natan la'avadav. Your fields and your vineyards and your orchards he's going to take and he's going to give to his servants. So if you put these two paragraphs side by side, the avadim hanitzavim alav, the servants standing before him, the sadot, the kremim, the serei alafim, the serei meot, the accusation that Shaul says to the people, you're hiding out because you're harboring him because you think you're going to get a better deal from the king. Well, this is what a king can do. This is what I've done because that's what a king can do. You think you're going to get a better deal from David. What's the end result? That the contrast here is Shaul revealing to us that he's, in a sense, sinking deeper and deeper into the abyss of the negative side of Parashat HaMelech, while David is beginning to gather together the group that's going to support him, over whom he is going to lead, not by confiscating, not by taking their lands, they don't have any lands to give, and not by taking their children and putting them into his army, he has no army to, but by being David, by leading by example, by leading by the force of his personality and the force of his morality. It's a very interesting contrast. These people have everything to blame against Shaul, and those are the people naturally going to migrate to David. But it's interesting that David will exercise very powerful moral control over these people. He will keep them in line. There's an expression that appears later in the parak describing Avdei David. Actually, we're going to jump to it. If you take a look at parak of Hay. This is the story of Naval HaKarmeli. We're going to come to Perech Hafei. Naval HaKarmeli is a very powerful story.
357.
Pasuk Yud. Vaya'an Naval et Avdei David. Naval and David are... Actually, you know what? Let's go back a little bit. This is a really good story to see the context of who David is. You have a few minutes? You have 3 minutes. Yeah, this will work. Start from the beginning of the parak. I'm going to not do the whole thing, but I just want to. Pasuk bet. V'ish b'ma'onu ma'aseh b'kamel, v'ish gadol ma'od, v'lo tzon 3,000 ve'elef izim, v'yi b'gzoz et tzono b'karmel. There's a certain man in the Karmel. This is not Karmel in the north. This is Karmel in Eretz Yehuda in the south. It's a different area. And there's a man who's great, wealthy, 3,000 son, 3,000 alafim, 3,000 sheep, and elafizim, and 1,000 goats, and he's got everything. His name is Naval. Mm-hmm. His wife's name is Avigail. V'ishtavatzecha, v'ifatoa, v'ishkashe, v'ram, alalim, v'hu kalibi. He is a difficult man. He is a worthless man. No morals, no values. V'shma David b'midbar, ki gozez Naval etzono, v'ishlach David asera na'arim, v'yomer David le'na'arim, alu karmela uvatem al Naval, u'shaltem lo b'shmin l'shalom. Tends his na'arim, and he says to him, listen, go and meet this guy Naval, sell him in my name, shalom. V'amartem kol l'chai, v'ata shalom uv'etcha shalom, v'chol asher l'cha shalom, a peace to you, everything you should have at peace. And this is what you should ask for. V'ata shamati ki gozuzim l'cha, ata haro'im asher l'cha, ayu imanu, l'echlamnum, lo nifka mehem o'uma, ki ko yemei yotam b'kamel, your shepherds were with us, nothing happened to them, they were protected, they were well looked after, they were able to do their job. Sha'al et na'arech v'yagid l'cha, go ask your na'arim, and they'll tell you how well we looked after them. V'yimtzu na'arim chem be'enecha, ki al yom tov banu, t'nana et asher timtza yadcha l'avadecha l'v'necha David. Okay, so now it's time to pay up. Give us payment. We protected your people, we protected your flock, we protected your na'arim. Now pay us. This is exactly how David operates. And Latov, I mean, it's a positive description. This is what this is Parnasa. V'yavo nare David v'yidabru al Naval kochol adonim eile b'shem David v'yenuchu. The Na'arim come and they tell Naval exactly what David had said. V'yan Naval et avdei David v'yomer. Here's his answer. Mi David u'mi ben Yishayeyo. In Ben Yishai, who is this David? Who is this Ben Yishai? Hayom Rabu Avadim Hamitparzim Ish Mipnei Adonav. Today there is an abundance of servants who rebel against their master. You hear the reference?
David against
Shaul. His people. In other words, all these people who have turned against Shaul, their anger is to Shaul because he's the one who's taken all their, confiscated all their land and taxed them to death. They are described here as avadim hamitparzim mipnei Adonav, servants who rebel against their master. And now they're going to take my bread and my food, right? So he gets very angry. The rest of that story is not our subject for now. But you can see the sense of it. I want to show you one more reference and to see where David fits into the picture. Come back one paragraph. Chaf Dalid. Beginning of Perech of Dalid. This is Perech of Dalid is the famous story where the first instance where Shaul is in a cave and David has the opportunity to kill Shaul to protect himself, and he doesn't do it. And his servants want to. So take a look, Pasuk Vav. Vayomer la Nashav. He says to his people, Chalilali me'ashem imeset ha'davar hazeh la'adoni l'mashiach Hashem. God forbid that I should do this to the anointed one of God. Lishloach yadi bo ki mashiach Hashem, will stretch out my hand against him to kill him, to harm him. He's the mashiach Hashem. He's the anointed one of God. Vayishasa David et anashav ba'davarim v'lo netanam lakum el Shaul. David kept his people in line. Refused to let them harm Shaul. V'Shaul kame me'arav ha'yelech badarach. So against whom is the wrath of these malcontents? Clearly against the king. And possibly for good reason. And David is the leader, but David is able to keep them in line and to maintain that moral compass that says, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to stoop to that level. And so here you have the contrast between Shaul and his operation and the kingship and the moral abyss to which Malchut Shaul is sinking, and the beginning of the rise of David's leadership. And as the sun is setting in Shaul's reign, the sun is beginning to rise on David. And that's the story of this gedud. We didn't get the story of Moav. We'll do that Bezrat Hashem next week.